That brings us to the next part of the story, because then the word of the Lord comes to Elijah saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." He said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arise, you shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram. Also, you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you shall anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat of Abel-Mehalomah, as prophet in your place. Whoever escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall kill, and whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall kill. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God." A little bit uncomfortable saying the word of the Lord, thanks be to God, as we close out that passage. We have moved forward, obviously, a couple generations. The kings have not gotten any better. And if you ever wonder how we got from supposedly the 50s and 60s as the glory days of the church to today, when people are leaving the church in droves and things like that, I want to remind you that this passage is two generations after Solomon, three after David. It really doesn't take that long. The kingdom has split north and south. The 10 northern kingdoms, the 10 northern tribes, and they really don't like each other that much. They've chosen separate leaders, and Elijah is a prophet to the northern kingdom. Ahab has followed the pattern of Solomon, and he has married a wife from another country. Well, the problem with that is that those wives come with gods from other countries. And Jezebel is both often referred to as a priestess of Baal and the queen. And she would like to influence the nation of Israel in certain directions. And Elijah is trying to influence them in the other direction. And they've had their challenge together on top of the mountain. And Elijah has perhaps gone overboard and killed 450 prophets. And Jezebel sends him this message. "By the way," and this is clearly a politician speaking, "may the gods do more so, such and more so to me, if by this time tomorrow I haven't made you like them." You know, if this was an action adventure movie, she would just say, "I'm going to kill you." But she's a queen in ancient Israel. So what happens next, and really what happens even before we get to this passage, is Elijah reminds us that even the prophets of God are human. If we were reading that passage about the sacrifice on top of the mountain, the priests of Baal build their altar for a sacrifice. Elijah builds his altar for a sacrifice. Wood, sacrificial offering, stones. And then they're supposed to pray to God, their gods, for the fire to consume it. And whoever is consumed first, their God wins. Okay? And Elijah sits there and he douses the wood with water and goes, "Hey, my God can handle this." And then he starts taunting. "What, Baalites? Is your God asleep?" The Hebrew is less polite than that. They translate it politely. The Hebrew is your God on the toilet? And then God consumes both offerings, and Elijah slaughters the priests. And then we come to today's passage. So if you think Elijah might have been a little too human and a little too caught up in the competition, that might not be a bad interpretation. The Hebrew doesn't say that he's afraid. It says he saw what had happened. And if you've ever done something and then realized what you did, you may have that understanding of this text. And Elijah does what most of us have done at some point in our lives. He runs away. Today, we run away in different ways. We screen our cell phone calls. We don't answer that text or that email, and we pretend we're not at home when somebody comes to the door. A little less complicated in the biblical days, but Elijah runs away to the wilderness. Wilderness is both a metaphor and a reality. The queen and her retinue want to kill him. Probably hanging out in the city is not the best thing to do. So he goes out to the wilderness, and you're going to hear, you may have heard already, several echoes to other scriptural narratives in this part. He goes out, he leaves his friends behind, he goes further out into the wilderness, he sits himself down under a tree and says, "I wish I was dead." Well, we know of another prophet who throws a pouty little session underneath a tree in Jonah when he's really disappointed that God hasn't smited all of the unbelievers. Well, Elijah even got to watch God smite all the unbelievers, and he's unhappy. In the sentiment, we hear the sentiment of Job, who after a week of suffering and sitting with his friends, you guys remember how supportive his friends are, right? He says, "Lord, I just wish I'd never been born." So we have that. We have the fact that he lays down and goes to sleep ready to die, which actually mirrors Hagar and Ishmael being sent out into the wilderness. And it mirrors an encounter he has with the widow who is out gathering sticks. And she says, "I'm just going home to cook our last meal so we can lay down and die." In that story, he miraculously and a little bit boorishly demands food and then makes sure that it happens. And so that's going to be echoed, because when he somehow wakes up, the scriptural NRSV translation is kind of that an angel taps him on the shoulder and wakes him up and says, "Take and eat. Otherwise, you're going to be too tired for the journey." And there is a loaf of bread, a cake of bread, really, and a pitcher of water. Now, if I were to stand behind this table and pull out a piece of bread and a pitcher, what would you think is happening? Right? For the Israelites, they would think of Moses striking the rock, and they would think of manna in the wilderness. So there's a lot of stuff going on right here. The angel says, "Take, eat." This is your roughly 9th century BC Snickers commercial that you're not yourself when you're hungry. "Take, eat. You got a lot of work to do." And Elijah takes and eats, and he sleeps again, and he gets woken by the angel again, and he gets fed again, and then he goes on his way to Horeb, 40 days and 40 nights. Now, where have we heard 40 before? Comes up just a couple times. Comes up with Exodus, comes up with Noah, those sorts of things. It's that language about a long time, and an important long time. And he gets to Horeb, which you may know better by its other name, Sinai. And here's where you need to put on your little imagination cap just a little bit and pretend you're reading the voices to your children or your grandchildren. Because how we hear God say, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" is going to matter. It could be, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" It could be, "What are you doing here, Elijah? Kind of depends on, you know, how grumpy a mood we want God to be in when Elijah gets there. Elijah's answer is really to the point. Well, look, they've forsaken you. They've torn down your altars. They have put the prophets to the sword, and I'm the only one left, and they're trying to get me. Did you really want me to stay with them? Earlier, when he's under the tree moaning, he says that I'm just as bad or as no good as my ancestors. And we might think about that as meaning he's talking about his father or his grandfather. He's really talking about the other prophets. Because how many of the other prophets have been able to convince Israel to stay on the straight and narrow? I think the grand total is zero. And so we've come to that part of the story that perhaps we're most familiar with, that we've heard the most times and that is most memorable as an image in our head, where there's a wind that splits rocks and split mountains, but God is not in the wind. And there's an earthquake, but God is not in the earthquake. And there's a fire, but God is not in the fire. And then there's quiet. I mean, we can't even really do quiet. You know, we fidget, the air conditioner comes on, the fan goes, somebody drops something, somebody snorts behind their mask or coughs, whatever it is. The Hebrew for it is really ambiguous. It's something between murmuring to a glottal stop, which is basically the sound you make when you try to say the word herb with that soft H and can't figure out how to get it out. And that is when that silence is when Elijah knows that something is different. And so he covers his face. He fit really well in 21st century America and goes out to see God. Now, the last time we got a story about somebody covering their face and seeing God on the top of Sinai, Moses got handed the Ten Commandments. Something important may be about to happen. What happens is that God asks him the same stinking question. Elijah, what are you doing here? And Elijah gives him the same answer. The Israelites have forsaken you. They've torn down your altars. They've violated the covenant. They've slaughtered the prophets, and now they're coming for me. And God basically says, well, that's nice, Elijah, but you haven't finished what I asked you to do yet. We can probably be a little more charitable to God than that. God says, here's what we're going to do about it. Or here's what you're going to do about it with my help, Elijah. It is, we found in Sunday school, a frustratingly long plan. Okay. The way we read it is kind of like Elijah's going to get down off the mountain. He's going to go do this thing. He's going to go do this thing. He's going to go do this thing. And the problem is going to be solved. So the first thing he's going to do is going to go anoint Hazael king over Aram. Then he's going to anoint Jehu king over Israel. And then he's going to anoint Elisha. This is where you really need to enunciate Elisha. His successor. To put it in context, Jehu is the grandson of the king after Ahab. It's not going to happen fast. It's not going to be turned around in a hurry. So we have to consider, how do we want to look at this? Do we want to throw our hands up in the air and go, well, God does as God does in God's own sweet time, which I think is sometimes our frustration with our prayers. God seems to take an awfully long time to do things. Or do we look at it that Elijah is going to be around long enough to anoint the grandson of the next king? Right? There's something to that. But ultimately, I want us to look at how God handles a fearful prophet. Now, Elijah has seen and done miracles. He is fully aware of the power of God. And yet, when push comes to shove and the queen says, I'm going to get you by the end of the day, he hits the road. And I think that there's a point when many of us have spent a lot of time being faithful, and yet we've come to a point where there is something that frightens us so much, our first and perhaps our strongest response is to run. So how does God respond to that? Well, God doesn't let his running turn into death. Elijah finds a broom tree, he lays down, he takes a nap, he's just ready to sleep until the big sleep. And God is not willing to let that happen. Now, Elijah, by the time he's done with his ministry, has all sorts of miraculous food brought to him. He has ravens feed him in a wadi. He has an angel of the Lord show up under a broom tree with bread and water. I mean, this should not be a surprise to the man. But God is not going to let him quit, give up, die in fear, die believing that Jezebel has more power than God. So there's this really odd encounter, though, where the angel's like, you've got a long way to go. And now that we've heard the task list, he's got like 40 years to go. That's a long way to go. But Elijah is also doing what we so often do when we are afraid. He's running back to the last place that was different, that was powerful, that was comforting, that held promise. He is running back to the place where God said, here's the Ten Commandments, Moses, where the top of the mountain was shrouded in smoke and fire. He's running back to one of the last places that the people of God really experienced God. It is unclear from the scriptural text if he intended to go to Horeb from the very beginning or not. I certainly don't think it was on his list the entire time because he was just ready to die a day or two out into the wilderness. But he goes to the mountain. And on the mountain, it's an interesting conversation because God doesn't say, Elijah, you've left your post. Turn around, get back to work. You don't have any vacation days left. What are you doing here? God says, why are you here? What are you doing? And he listens to Elijah basically vomit out all of his anger and his frustration with the people of God. And we've read enough Old Testament and we've been around the church long enough to know that there's plenty of reasons to be frustrated with the people of God. And then God says, you clearly need to have a Sinai encounter. So step out on the mountain and I will pass by. And it's not the wind, and it's not the earthquake, and it's not the fire. That God is in, all of which may have been a part of Elijah's competition with the Baalites. It is in the quiet afterwards. I don't honestly think Elijah needs any more chaos in his life or any more destruction or damage. What he needs is something different and something that he can only get from God. If I want hectic, I can go find hectic. Right? If I want to be busy, I can go be busy. God doesn't have to be a part of that. If I want to find destructive, I can find destructive. What I can't find is rest. And Elijah has actually gotten that rest at several points along this journey in a way that he did not have before. And basically his complaint to God is that he doesn't have rest, that he is being hounded, that there's too much to do, that the people have forsaken God. So Elijah is going to go out from here, and he's got a long ministry ahead of him. It made me ask, you know, how is it that we think God is going to handle us when we're afraid and running? What places do we run to when we think the chips are down? It's funny, you know, virtually every airport in the country has a chapel in it. I've never actually seen anybody in a chapel in the airports, but every airport has a chapel. Almost every hospital has a chapel. People come into this space when they don't know what else to do. But these aren't the only places we run to. We run to family, we run to friends. Sometimes we run to cemeteries. We run to the last place where we saw someone. Last place we were safe, the last place we were comfortable. The last place things were different from how they are now. I think that's ultimately what Elijah is doing, is that he is being the very human prophet of God. He taunted. He got a little overzealous. He has been very zealous for the Lord. He will tell God twice. That takes a certain level of confidence, doesn't it? God, I've been working really hard for you. You should know that, God. And then he realizes what has happened. And he gets Jezebel's message, and he just runs off. God doesn't tell him he's lost faith. God doesn't tell him that he has failed. God doesn't tell him he's a disappointment. God provides the gift of God's presence, of some quiet, of some nourishment for the journey, and a reminder of what Elijah is supposed to be about. I think if we look back at our own journeys, we can see some of those pieces coming into place in our own journeys as things have gotten hard. That sometimes God works that rest in. Sometimes because we have run out of the ability to go on. That sustenance is somehow provided even as we're in the wilderness. And that somehow we often end up at a place where it is hard to dispute the reality of our God. Elijah has a long, tumultuous ministry ahead of him. Remember that he is one of the people that in the first century, the crowds want to know if Jesus and John are just Elijah. We are not called to be perfect in our faith. We're not even called to be incredibly persistent all the time, as we see with Elijah. We're called to keep running back to God, to look for rest and sustenance, to accept it when it comes, and to hear that there is still more to do, and sadly, to want it to happen much faster than God often works. If Elijah can do all this and still be considered the prophet par excellence? Do you really think any of us are getting tossed out for fear and doubt? This word to Elijah is a word to us that being afraid isn't the end, and running away isn't the end, and that God will meet us along our fearful journey and try to turn us back around. To God alone be the glory this day and forevermore. Amen.